You are listening to the Dan Patrick Show on Fox Sports Radio.
We were curious the number of NFL playoff games that have gone into overtime since 1980. 7.3% of playoff games have gone into overtime. We are proposing no overtime. No overtime during the regular season. We'll see if Florio will write up a little blurb on us that the Dan Patrick Show is suggesting no overtime. No overtime. We'll find out what the strategy would look like with these teams if there's no overtime there. And then the postseason, we could have overtime. I didn't realize that these things were on the docket. Just proposals here. Roughing the passer. And it feels like they always try to sneak it by the goalie here. I don't know. At the owner's meeting, like nobody's looking. They go, everybody's out. Let's vote. All in favor. Aye. And it passes. Let's bring in Mike Florio, Pro Football Talk Live co-host. Mike, we are proposing overtime during the regular season. What do you think?
Old school, pre-1974. That's how it used to be. Ties. Do you like ties? I don't like ties. I guess it's on the two teams involved to make sure there isn't a tie. And with so much more scoring now and the two-point conversion, it's easier to avoid a tie than it would have been back in the early 70s and prior to that. And Dan, you're onto something in this respect. I believe that this push to go back to true sudden death overtime with this spot and choose concept, which I actually am intrigued by.
Okay, wait, explain that though, Mike.
Okay.
So this is just proposed. Right. Of a new overtime possibility.
A new overtime possibility proposed by the Ravens. There's two types. There's a sudden death and there's a straight 7.5 minutes. I'm told Bill Belichick prefers that. 7.5 minutes of football, whatever the score is at the end, that's the final score, win, lose, or draw. Spot and choose means in lieu of a coin flip to determine first possession, one team picks where the first drive begins. For example, our own 20-yard line, the minus 20, as the football people call it, your own 20-yard line. One team picks the spot, and the other team says whether they're going to take the ball and play offense or give the other team the ball and play defense. It's as equitable as it can be. It's as fair as it can be. It reminds me of the old Sesame Street sketch where, you know, you share a cookie by one person breaks it in half and the other one chooses which half they want. Totally fair. And I think it adds layers and levels of strategy that will probably drive coaches and analytics departments crazy. But it's so much better. If you're going to go back to true sudden death, it's so much better than the coin flip. Now, the two ways the Ravens are proposing it, sudden death with up to 10 minutes or this Belichick preferred 7.5 minutes, play that full amount and whoever's ahead at the end wins, which creates, I think, an additional strategic angle. If you've only got 7.5 minutes, you want to make sure that you have enough time to do something with the ball when you get it back. So it's just layers and levels of strategy that I think would drive coaches crazy, but I think it would be fair to both teams.
Could I have you start on the 1 yard line?
Well, you could pick the 1 yard line.
But
the other team gets to choose whether to be offense or defense.
Okay.
That's the beauty of it.
Okay. Okay.
And I'm told, Dan, that the analytics people are viewing the 13, the minus 13 as the break even point. That if the team that picks the yard position says 12 or less, then that's when you're likely to choose to play defense. 14 or more, you're likely to choose offense in the standard case. But think about it. Your quarterback. How you feel about your defense? How you feel about whatever plays you have left in your game plan for the day? How you feel about your kicker? What the weather conditions are? So many things are going to go into that decision.
Are they voting on this? I know it's just a proposal. Does it get put up for vote?
Well, they're presenting it to the competition committee to try to get them on board with it. It has more heft, has more weight if the competition committee is behind it. But the most important person to have behind it is the commissioner. And my understanding is the commissioner likes it because, number one, it makes the game shorter. And this gets back to the point you're making with overtime. I think they want the games to be shorter, Dan, not for this year, but I think it's some year down the road, 4, 5, 6, whenever, they're going to start dropping games into more standalone windows. And this Tuesday night football that we saw a couple of times this year, Wednesday afternoon at 3 o'clock, they're going to get creative about having more standalone games, because as gambling proliferates and as real-time in-game betting becomes technologically available, where you can sit at home with your phone and what you see at the stadium is what's coming into your home at that moment, so there's no latency, it makes more sense to have not nine games being played at once, as many games as possible that are the only game where everyone's watching, everyone's engaged, and everyone's betting one play at a time on those games. So you make the game shorter. Here's why you make the game shorter. Because you're going to have teams that are playing on a five-day break, four-day break, six-day break. You can't be playing for 70 minutes. So I think that's why they want to make the game shorter. So your idea from that perspective is brilliant.
Thank you.
Because every game is capped at 60 minutes.
Could you propose that? I don't have the commissioner's ear. Could you?
You think I do?
Oh, you don't either?
No. But I'm sure he would not turn up his nose at a good idea. I just think that the idea of going back to we'd have to accept ties.
And but the strategy of a tie in the fourth quarter, like imagine that now all of it changes your philosophy of what you're doing. Instead of how many times they're playing for overtime. Now you can't play for overtime. Nobody's taking a knee.
Yeah.
Now you actually are saying, are we comfortable with a tie against this team, or do we want to go for a win?
Or you know, go for one versus go for two. That
yes.
When overtime was the rule pre-74, you didn't have that option. That's the beauty of it. I think, and here's where I think you're onto something. The way the game is today, I think that there would be fewer ties, and that you know, with all the analytics and the strategy and going for two and all the different things you can do, I just think that you would see less just kind of shrugging. I think they just used to shrug at a tie. Yeah, it's a tie. Okay, we'll get them next week. I think it would be far different if that were the case now.
All right, a couple of things. I know we're short on time. The roughing the passer reviewable, that's being proposed, correct?
Yes, and I don't like it. I don't like it one bit. The reason I don't like it is 2019, pass interference, replay review, calls and non-calls. The standard kept changing. You can watch the available angles, and you can see a glancing blow. And if it's frame by frame, is that forcible contact with the head of the quarterback? I don't like it. And think about it, Dan. Every interception, what's going to be part of the replay review? Hey, was there contact with the quarterback? Was it possibly roughing the passer? I like the concept, but I don't like the execution that it likely would entail, because we saw it 2 years ago and what a disaster pass interference was. I continue to be a believer, and the Ravens are proposing this as well, the booth umpire, the extra member of the crew who sees what we see at home and can talk directly to the referee and say, drop a flag, pick up a flag, you guys are making a mistake. No different than another member of the crew who runs up and talks to the referee and they pick up a flag. That's what they need. And they've been reluctant to do it, but I think that's the key, because what you see when you're on the field and what you see at home are two very different things. They need a referee, an official who sees what we see at home and can talk to the people on the field.
Mike Florio, Pro Football Talk Live co-host, of course, his website, profootballtalk.com. The fumbling the ball out of the end zone.
Clark Hunt, the owner of the Chiefs, the team that benefited from that rule in the divisional round of the playoffs, suggested before the Super Bowl that rule would be looked at by the competition committee. There's no proposal yet on that rule. And I just don't think they're going to change it. It's always been there. You know, once upon a time, the rule was if you threw an incomplete pass into the end zone and it hit the turf, it was a touchback and the defense got the ball at its own 20. There's just been this sacred treatment of the end zone, and that's where this comes from. As unfair as it is, here's the reality. It's fair in that it affects both teams equally. And, you know, it may screw you in one game and you may benefit from it in another game. The thing I don't like about it, though, it penalizes effort. And you see a guy making maximum effort to reach the ball out to the pylon. And if the ball slips out of his hands and just goes out of the end zone 1 inch in, you lose the ball. If it goes out short of the end zone by an inch, you keep the ball. If it hits that pylon, you lose the ball. That's what I don't like about it.
How about we extend the end zone?
Like CFL?
Yeah.
That would make Well, you know what you'd have to do? You'd have to go back and rebuild half the stadium, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
That would be the problem.
I'm all in. I'm good with that, too. Like, yeah, help the economy. Create some jobs there. Anything new? Roethlisberger re-signing. It felt like he had to fall on his own sword to take less to stay there. But your thoughts when Roethlisberger announced he was coming back?
General business advice for anyone out there who's ever negotiating a salary with his or her employer. Once you say, I don't care how much I get paid this year, you can't take that back, Dan. And once he said that, he's not getting $19 million this year. The question is, what's he getting? And that's why it took so long. If he's getting $19 million this year, it's a half-hour negotiation to figure out how they're going to move the money around and reduce his cap number. Once he said that, he's getting squeezed. And I'm surprised he only got squeezed for $5 million. So it gives him some cap space. I think they're delusional in thinking that they've got a championship team. This isn't 2005 Jerome Bettis, let's come back for one more run and go win a Super Bowl. There are some great teams in the AFC, and yeah, they were 11-0 last year. 8 of those games could have gone either way.
I also wondered about Deshaun Watson, the timing of when, if you're going to trade him, when do you trade him? And I thought, you know, I just have a for sale sign or, you know, like a yard sale. I just say, come on in, give me your offers like Detroit did. But I'm wondering, is he more likely to get traded closer to the draft? Does that make more sense? But I don't even know if we're there yet. But what do you think about if he is traded, what the timing would be for that?
Dan, I think with all these teams that are looking for quarterbacks, evaluating their options, the problem is if you wait until the draft to trade Deshaun Watson, there are teams that will have made other plans at quarterback. And then they're not at the table. And that could be a team that helps drive another team up to a higher price. You know, John McClain of the Houston Chronicle echoed something that we had said a few weeks ago. They should get the Jets and the Dolphins in a bidding war. Do it now. And hey, if you don't trade for him, you're going to have to deal with him twice per year and play them against each other. You know, Russell Wilson's agent very artfully got it out there, the four teams that he'd be willing to accept a trade to. At some point, the Texans need to find out where are the places Deshaun Watson would play. Let's get those teams at the table. But first they have to come to the conclusion that they're even going to do it. I feel like at this point they are in the I don't know, anger, denial, bargaining, depression, acceptance. They're probably still in the denial phase. and they just refuse. They refuse to accept the fact that this guy is never going to play for them again. And Dan, have you seen or heard anything that contradicts the prevailing notion that he's never putting that blue helmet on his head again?
No. And that's why I didn't understand why they just didn't say, come on in, compete against each other, and hopefully we'll get an even bigger treasure trove here. The Russell Wilson, it doesn't feel like there's any real news on the Russell Wilson front. We're trying to make news. I guess his agent said, or somebody said, this is the reason why he likes the Bears. That doesn't mean he's getting traded because he likes Matt Nagy in the offensive line here, but I haven't heard anything more internally about this situation. So did Russ accomplish what he wanted to accomplish when he came on our show?
Well, let's think about the timeline. The stuff he said on your show was jarring. And I've never heard a quarterback talk that candidly about his situation. I think Tom Brady's to blame or credit for all of that, because these guys see what happened with Brady. They want to flex their muscles. That was great. But then it got quiet for a couple of weeks. So you kind of start thinking, well, maybe they've worked things out. Well, then comes the Athletic article that pulls some scabs off of the situation. Mark Rogers says what he says on the record, which was as jarring as the comments Russell Wilson made. And now it's quiet again. Just because it's quiet doesn't mean nothing's happening. I mean, Seahawks have to be considering their options. And the four teams are identified by Rodgers: Raiders, Bears, Saints, Cowboys. How do you not, at a minimum, get all the decision makers together and say, what would we be willing to do here? And I've said this about the Saints, Dan. When you look at the cap mess that they're in and the guys that they're going to have to part ways with, how do you not call the Seahawks and say, just tell us who you want? Because there's a chance they want some guys that you're going to cut anyway. Or maybe they want a guy that you're on the fence about so you can trade him and keep one of the guys that you're thinking about cutting. So I just think that Russell Wilson is good enough that those four teams need to at least explore it, even if it means calling up the Seahawks and saying, tell us what you want, and we'll see if we can come close to it.
Because Russ can't have his feelings hurt if you reach out to the Saints, whereas Deshaun Watson, you know, maybe that's different, or some of these other teams where they reach out and you go, oh, gosh, don't let him find out that you reached out. Russ's people probably go, okay. Like, you have to do your due diligence. If I'm Seattle, I just find out. Like, I just want to know. If it gets worse, then at least I know, hey, you know what? The Saints will give us this. Hey, you know what the Bears will give us is this. Pit those two against each other, and let's see what we have here.
Here's what it comes down to. And this was my takeaway after reading the item in The Athletic. Russell Wilson views himself as Patrick Mahomes, and he has every right to view that. We haven't seen him in a situation where he is a Patrick Mahomes, where the offense runs through him and it's orchestrated to get the most out of his abilities. That's what he wants. If the Seahawks don't view Russell Wilson the way Russell Wilson views Russell Wilson, then trade him to a team that does. Because necessarily, whatever that team offers will reflect what they think of Russell Wilson, and the Seahawks will look at it and say, well, these bastards are crazy. why are they offering this for this guy? Let's take it and run.
Have a great weekend, Mike. Always great to talk to you, buddy. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. See you, pal.
Mike Florio, Pro Football Talk. Thanks for listening to the Dan Patrick Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning, 9 to noon Eastern, or 6 to 9 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for the Dan Patrick Show at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR. Or stream us live on the Peacock app.
Hey, what's up, everybody? It's me, 3-time Pro Bowler LeVar Arrington, and I couldn't be more excited to announce a new podcast called Up On Game. What is Up On Game, you ask? Along with my fellow Pro Bowler, TJ Hushmanzada, and Super Bowl champion, yep, that's right, Plexico Burress. You can only name a show with that type of talent on it, Up On Game. We're going to be sharing our real-life experiences loaded with teachable moments. Listen to Up On Game with me, LeVar Arrington, TJ Hushmanzada, and Plexico Burress on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Bring in Tim McMahon, ESPN NBA staff writer, who joins us on the program. Do you think that the Utah Jazz were singled out here by LeBron and company, that they were the last two picks, Rudy Gobert and Mitchell, Donovan Mitchell?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if LeBron and KD intentionally did this. I don't know if they, you know, got together on plot of this, but is it disrespect to the Jazz, to the team that has the best record in the NBA? Will it be perceived as disrespect in Utah? Yeah, absolutely. There's no question about it. And I really, for Rudy Gobert especially, he's obviously the guy who went dead last. You know, he's the guy who felt like he had to wait an extra couple of years just to get invited to the All-Star game. And really, you know, the video game stuff, come on. You think, was LeBron playing with the New Orleans Pelicans growing up? I don't know. I don't know that he had too much experience playing with the Pelicans growing up. But it kind of felt like LeBron and KD, again, whether it was intentionally or not, were basically saying, you might have the best record in the league, but you really don't belong at the top level of the NBA.
Yeah, so using LeBron's logic, if Luka Doncic played in Utah, then he wouldn't take him because Karl Malone and John Stockton play there, right? That's what he's telling me.
Yeah, blame it on Stockton and Malone for sure.
Yeah. I like this. I'm not big on the All-Star weekend, but if it's here and they're willing to have some fun with this, with the slam dunk. So they're cramming the slam dunk contest in at halftime, right?
Yeah, and not the most thrilling dunk contest field that I think we've ever seen, but such is life.
And Alex Caruso of the Lakers turned down the invitation?
Yeah, when a 6'3" white dude who's balding is turning down dunk contest invitations, we've got some issues.
And you have the 3-point contest where you do have some, you know, you got great shooters in there, so that. And I like watching it, but
yeah, the 3-point contest has significantly more sizzle than the dunk contest. Let's be honest. We all wish Zion would have accepted a dunk contest invitation. That's what we want to see. And then, you know, Toppin might throw down some nice stuff. We wanted to see Zion on that stage. And so that's a bummer that he didn't take the invitation. Caruso, we can live without.
Although I might have been interested in seeing Alex Caruso in the dunk contest.
Listen, the man can fly, and especially since, you know, he's just kind of acknowledged that you know, he's got a little endorsement deal, and his knowledge, like, going full buzz. He's all aerodynamic now. He can really get up.
I had a couple of things here. I don't know who's going to be traded here. It feels like Kyle Lowry's available or sort of available. How available is Lowry, and where do you see him landing?
Well, and that's the big question, because at this point, it does not look like Bradley Beal will be available. So Kyle Lowry would then become the most impactful player potentially on the trade market. And, you know, when you look at fits for him, the one that really stands out is Philly, and not just because he's from there, not because he's a Nova guy, although that's a nice little storyline, but simply because of how he would fit with the 76ers, how he would fit giving a third star to a team that obviously has Joel Embiid playing at an MVP level, you know, Ben Simmons. And also, you know, Daryl Morey is as aggressive as any, personnel executive in the league in terms of in-season trades. He tried to make the Harden trade happen. That didn't. You know, Lowry would not require giving up Ben Simmons, but I fully expect that Daryl Morey will make an aggressive pitch because, you know, the 76ers are one of these handful of teams that obviously have a legitimate shot at winning a championship this season.
NBA analyst Greg Anthony was on the show on Wednesday. He disagreed with me, saying that this was a two-way street with the Rockets. They also quit on James Harden and vice versa. I know you did a deep dive on this, but separate fact from fiction here with what went on. I said I couldn't vote for Harden if I had a vote for MVP because he quit on the Rockets. He showed up out of shape. He did not want to be there. And this is a team that he helped build and deconstruct. And now I'm going to have him as MVP in the same season. I can't see it happening. So what did you find out with your deep dive?
I mean, look, I understand what you're saying. And obviously it was a bad look the way that that he gave up on the Rockets. But I also think if you have an MVP vote, you have to just evaluate based on pure value. And his value to the Brooklyn Nets, I think you have to include James Harden in that conversation. Yeah. Now, I wouldn't say that the Rockets quit on Harden. I think you can definitely take a look at some of the moves they made, some of the moves they didn't make, you know, not going into the luxury tax his last few years, and you can nitpick it. But they were, you know, they were trying, like, you know, this summer, they were aggressive trying to kind of remodel the roster, getting Christian Wood, hoping they could convince him to stay. But obviously there was just no hope. But again, if you talk about what really went wrong with the Rockets, what was kind of the move that had this whole thing tumbling down, it was giving up Chris Paul and a whole bunch of picks for Russell Westbrook. And James Harden not only was on board with that, but he was pounding the table wanting it to happen.
Yeah, that's where I don't have any sympathy. Not that Harden's looking for it, but you wanted these players. You wanted to get rid of these players. And so is he playing at an all-star MVP? Absolutely, yeah. But that doesn't mean he should be the MVP. It feels like, you know, earlier and earlier in the season, we're looking at MVP candidates, Tim, and maybe this is just sports talk radio. We need content. With the NFL, we start talking about the MVP usually after, what, the first month of the season. Trying to handicap this, Jokic has been wonderful in Denver. Embiid has been great. Harden, you can throw him in there. LeBron, I know it's really important to him, but when it comes down to the MVP, what is this guy has to have this to get my MVP vote?
Yeah, Damian Lillard's the guy you didn't mention, or I think has to be in that discussion. Look, this is all ridiculously premature, but it's not media driven. It's player driven as well. I mean, hell, LeBron started lobbying for this MVP when he was still in the bubble, complaining about last year's MVP vote. So don't blame the media on this one.
Oh, no. We get blamed for this, Tim, because just because LeBron said it doesn't mean we have to pick up the baton and keep running with it.
We will give them the assist, all right, at the minimum. But, you know, these guys are lobbying themselves. So, right, a couple weeks ago, I would have said LeBron. Anthony Davis went out. Obviously, the Lakers have taken a dip here. My first half MVP would be Joel Embiid. He's averaging 30 and 10. He's a major impact player on the defensive end. The Sixers have the best record in the league. And his last statement going to the All-Star break was 40-19 against Rudy Gobert and the team with the best record in the league, hitting a clutch three to send that thing into overtime. And then not only has he been the best center in the NBA, but he's one of the best referees. He got Donovan Mitchell teed up in that game. So, you know, how do you not go with that?
Why is it that I look at Embiid the way I do James Harden, and he'll never be in as good enough shape as I think he should be, but he is still incredible? He might be in great shape, Tim. I just don't know if he's ever going to look like he's in great shape.
Yeah, and it's funny. If you look at him early in his career, he was definitely leaner. And look, the thing with Embiid is, can he play the vast majority of the games? And, you know, can he finish games strong? And so far this season, that's happened. But, you know, Embiid's a guy, you know, a lot of these guys, they like to complain about the voting of, you know, for him in particular, it's all NBA last year. How did Gobert get over? Dude, you missed 20-something games and your team finished sixth in the conference. The 76ers were disappointing last season. So if Embiid continues producing like he is, if the Sixers can fight off the Nets, stay atop the Eastern Conference, and he, you know, to do that, he's going to have to play the vast majority of the games. I think right now, you know, he would be number one on my ballot.
What's the update on Anthony Davis?
We will see. Obviously, that's a situation where, you know what, for the Lakers, the seeding isn't really important. You know, if they're a 3, 4, 5 seed even going in the Western Conference playoffs, if they have LeBron James and Anthony Davis healthy, they're going to feel like they're the team to beat. And you know what? I would agree with them. So, you know, I don't know what the exact timetable for AD is coming back after the All-Star break, but I do know that the Lakers aren't going to rush him. They're thinking long-term, as they should.
Yeah, I know this isn't headline worthy, but if they don't have Anthony Davis, they're not winning the championship this year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whatever it is, like, this is true load management for somebody who needs load management with Anthony Davis. Has the supporting cast for the Lakers lived up to its billing?
No. I mean, look, they've been a disappointment since AD went down. There's no question about that. There's too much on LeBron's plate. He hasn't been able to, you know, this was a chance for LeBron to kind of, really enhance his MVP case. That hasn't happened as well. But Marc Gasol has been a disappointment there. You know, Marc Gasol looks like a guy who has had a great career, but, you know, is out of gas at this point. You know, we'll see if that changes in the second half of the season. Montrezl Harrell is a guy with warts. You know, there's a reason that after he got sixth man of the year, the Clippers were just fine letting him walk across the hallway. The fact that he's playing 19 minutes in a game where Anthony Davis, is wearing sweats on the bench, I think that tells you a lot. And so, you know, they're not invincible. But again, if AD and LeBron are healthy, they can have some warts for that supporting cast. And that's still the team that I would put my money on.
If they're completely healthy and the Nets are completely healthy, you like the Lakers over the Nets?
I would, just because my general philosophy on the NBA is, if LeBron has a legitimate all-NBA co-star, I don't bet against him. You know, if he's healthy and has a legitimate all-NBA co-star, I'm not betting against him. And, you know, the Nets, offensively, they are unbelievable. But, you know, we'll see about their health as well. You know, KD obviously has been banged up. Kyrie is not exactly the most durable star in the league. We'll see how they're looking going to playoffs. But, no, the Nets obviously are a force to be reckoned with. And I think, you know, statistically and just by the eye test, the best offensive team that we've seen.
Tim, good to talk to you. Have fun at the All-Star weekend. We appreciate your time as always.
All right. Appreciate you having me.
That's Tim McMahon, ESPN NBA staff writer, and did a deep dive on the Rockets' divorce from James Harden. Thanks for listening to the Dan Patrick Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning, 9 until noon Eastern, 6 to 9 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. And you can find us on the iHeartRadio app at FSR or stream us live on the Peacock app. Ernie Johnson Jr., by the way, inside the NBA Sports Emmy Award-winning studio show. They have a documentary. It's a 4-part documentary series. And part was last night. First episode aired last night. Part 2 tonight, it's The Role Player at 9 Eastern. And Ernesto Johnson Jr. III joining us on the program. Good morning, Ernie.
And I think, good morning, Dan. I think the answer to your question is, why do those UFOs never land? As if they did see our show, they would just zip past. That's for sure. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. Paulie brought up a question to me right before I turned on the microphone to talk to you. And he said, how did Ernie get the job as the host of Inside the NBA? How did you get that?
I was working in Atlanta at a station you remember, local station there, because you were at CNN at the time. I was working for WSB. I was the weekend sports anchor. And the folks at Turner called one day and said, hey, would you want to come and work with us? Because we have this role for you as the host of our Wide World of Sports type show called U.S. Olympic Gold. And so we'd like you to host that for about a year and then become the host of the Goodwill Games in Seattle. And I said, that sounds good. I'll do that. There was really not much talk about the NBA at that point. As things worked out, there was a bit of a power struggle at the top of the Goodwill Games organization in between the time I was hired and the time that the Goodwill Games happened. And so Larry King became the host. And he had Hannah Storm and Nick Charles as his co-hosts. And I was assigned to all the sports that Bo doesn't know, as I referred to it at that point. Judo, team handball, modern pentathlon. I was kind of a jack of all trades covering things at the Goodwill Game. So that didn't exactly shake out the way it was supposed to, but certainly in the long run, when they asked me to host the NBA, that was a pretty good career move.
What was it like when Barkley first came to town?
Oh, I think we're all pumped. I mean, who wouldn't be? Because this was like landing the biggest free agent in history. And especially what made it even better, we had kind of resigned ourselves to the fact that he was going to go to NBC, he'll be over there with them. But Will keeps doing our thing. And Kenny and I, really enjoyed working together. But man, when you land that, it's like, oh, this is going to be so much fun. And my only question at the time was, when the novelty wears off, is Charles going to say, okay, that's enough of this. I've done three shows. Now, what else is there in my life? So, fortunately, he's been with us for like 21 years or 20 years now. So, he's been tremendous. And the whole key to that is he hasn't changed from the person he was as a player to the person he is on TV. And I think that's the danger. If you say all of a sudden, yeah, I've been kind of this outspoken guy and always opinionated, but when the red light goes on now, I'm going to hush up. And he's been so far over the edge on that, it's not even funny.
And I know that I don't mean this literally of rehearsing. How much rehearsing do you do? But we have these meetings before a show where you kind of go over topics that you're going to bring up, or you might clue somebody in on a joke that you might, a prank you play on somebody else. But how much of what is said on the show itself are you aware of before the show?
None of it, really, from those guys. No, not from them, because the production meeting, I'm in there with Tim Kiley and Jeremy Levin, who's ever producing that night. And, and about 20, 25 other people are on the call now on these Zoom production meetings.
Oh, Shaq and Charles and Kenny aren't in on
this? No. They've never been. And okay. And the thing is, part of that was by design, but part of it was like, they were like, I'm not going to sit in a meeting for three hours before we go on the air. And it just works out better for us, because if we do have something we want to spring on Kenny, an old piece of video where he gets his pocket picked at midcourt and somebody dunks, we don't want him saying, oh yeah, Kenny, get ready, because in the third segment of postgame, we're going to show this. So that's what we want to do. We just want to be able to spring things on people. And like the other night, we made up this game show for Shaq based on the fact that he, Pascal Siakam the week before, I had said, you got your eye on Pascal. And he said, no, I got my eye on Siakam. And it's like, so the next week we had a game show on the air. Could you name what's the first name of these players? And I told him, and I even told Shaq, I said, look, here's our stat sheet that we get from Elias or whoever. And so every name I'm going to give you, it's either in the top 20 of a department or the top 10 of a department. So, you know, here it is. Here's the last name, Monk. He plays for Charlotte. Eli. No, Malik. Okay. It was just what we do.
But do the producers have the green light, Ernie? I know it feels like the talent has the green light, but producers poking Hall of Fame players, everything, are you allowed to, suggest something that might hurt somebody's feelings or make them uncomfortable?
Yeah, I think we've done this long enough to know that no one's feelings are going to get hurt. If that were the case, then there wouldn't be a docuseries right now. People would have bailed on the show. I'm talking about people who were on the show long ago, because every one of us has been in the crosshairs from the other guys. So,
but Shaq does poke Charles. It feels like there's a little bit more tension. No,
it's man. Did you see Shaq the other night on the wrestling thing?
Yeah.
Okay. Shaq knows drama. Shaq knows TV. Shaq knows what's good. So if Shaq's going to raise his voice at Chuck because they can't agree on exactly where Kristaps Porzingis should be in the Dallas offense, it's not that they're going to step out in the parking lot. It's just, it's good conversation, but it's never forced. It's never something like, well, Shaq's just going to take this position so that we can have an argument on the air. It's just these guys have different philosophies on the game. So, no, but please rest assured there is not going to be this heavyweight bout of, 700 pounds of humanity wrestling on the floor.
Have you ever gotten hurt?
Have I ever gotten hurt?
On the show.
Doing what?
Like you're sort of in between those guys or you're just sort of an innocent bystander, then you somehow you're getting, it's collateral damage.
No, Dan, you know me. I'm a sensitive guy. I've only had my feelings hurt. There's been no physical pain.
It's emotional. Emotional pain. I get it. Why are we having All-Star Weekend?
Well, I think because it's a tradition, and it's because obviously there are monetary issues that I'm the last guy to ask about what something's going to mean from a fiscal standpoint. But I think the commissioner was pretty forthright about that. He said, look, we want to do this. And it looks like the fans want it because there's so much voting and that kind of thing. But he also was like, look, we need to do this financially. And so having it in Atlanta certainly reduces all the travel for all of our folks, because we have the game on TNT, so there's nobody flying cross country or flying here and there and that kind of thing, and all the equipment's here. So that's why we're having it. I was surprised. I didn't think, when the word came down that there was going to be one, I was surprised. I thought, just from my view, it was going to be, let's get to the All-Star break and then everybody sit back and take a deep breath and say, hey, we did this. All right. Now what can we do on the second half? But again, they have their reasons for doing it. And I'm in a few hours, I'm heading down to the Omni Hotel to quarantine for a couple of days and get tested today. I was tested last night. I'll get tested again today and tomorrow and then go to the arena Sunday and we'll do the thing.
The 4-part documentary on Inside the NBA. You can see it on TNT. Tonight is The Role Player. That's part two. What's the best item in your man cave or your office there?
Picture of me and my dad is pretty cool right there.
Oh, over your right shoulder?
Yeah, right there. From back in 59, I believe. His last year with the Braves. That was from like a father-son day. What else we got here? There's Georgia jersey that says Poppy, which is what my grandkids call me.
Yeah.
But there's a bunch of stuff in here. We call this the room because my dad sent me a clipping one time from the AJC that talked about our high school baseball game. And then he said, here, put this in the room when it's built. And so, he says that back in the 80s or the 70s. And so my wife and I said, we're going to make the room. So we just got a bunch of stuff in here, man. I have a very hard time throwing things away.
Any sports Emmys in there?
There's one right there.
Oh, okay.
There are a couple others upstairs.
My name on it. Probably should have my name on it.
Oh, without question. Yeah, I know. Without question.
Have you ever won it and felt guilty that I was out there in the audience and I didn't win it?
Yeah, I'm going to try to answer this in a way that doesn't sound like it's, you know, mamby-pamby BS. Whenever my name is called on that thing, it's like, how did that happen? Because I always look out there and I see, and you look at the list of guys, and every year it could go to anybody, any of those, you know, five that are nominated. But there's a special bittersweet feeling when you leave the stage and you and I lock eyes and I.
But I always wonder when I see you win, like, how did I not win when we lock eyes? So, like, how did that happen is what I say.
That's an upset for the ages. How did that happen?
Yeah, but I will say I am pretty phony when it comes to applauding because, I mean, I'm used to being there with Bob Costas. So when Costas doesn't win, I go, I'm in. Like, this is mine. And then,
when he's not nominated, everybody feels like,
oh, we're thrilled.
He got a chance.
And then all of a sudden, and the winner is Ernie Jones. And then I'm like, I got to be really quick because I like you and I root for you. But after a while, I don't like you and I don't root for you.
that's so kind of it. But you know what's funny is when you, just to the point we made, when for so many years, when Bob was nominated, it was like, okay, good. I'll go, but I'm just going to be there to cheer for Bob, you know, when his name is called. But those times when, hold on, I'm nominated. Costas is not the guy who's won 857 of these bad boys. We got a chance.
I don't know if I ever told you this story, but there was one year when Costas wasn't nominated for the best studio host. And I'm nominated along with Chris Berman. And I'm not sure who else was nominated, but I'm at the table. They had tables back then. And I'm sitting there and Chris Berman is talking to a couple of producers. Scott Ackerson was one of our producers. Bob Rauscher was a producer. And he's telling them that, I got to thank Tommy Me. So he's going down the list of everybody he's going to thank. And then he looks at me and he goes, good luck. Well, I win the sports Emmy, Ernie. I come back at the table, and it's as if I walked into a wake. I call my wife, and I she goes, you don't sound excited. I go, oh, hon, it's bad. I walked out of the sports Emmys after that, went down to Clark's, and had a drink. I brought the Emmy, and I sat at the bar with my Emmy, and I just had a couple of beers because I couldn't just sit there
by yourself.
Yes.
Oh my God. What an image.
I know, but I felt bad that, like, Chris, the reason why I won is that Chris opened the door for us to be able to have fun on SportsCenter. Really, Chris is as influential as anybody who's ever done this. But I felt bad. I'm just there with that sports Emmy, and he's right across the table from me. And I felt terrible. And I just remember going, I'm going down the street, and just went to a bar, sat there with my Emmy, drank. Oh, yeah.
My.
Yeah.
What a touching and disturbing story.
Yes, thank you. That is the title of my documentary. It's a four-part documentary. Touching
and disturbing.
The Dan Patrick story. play nice this weekend, by the way, okay?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Hey, by the way, Chuckster will not be with us for All-Star coverage.
Oh, his daughter's getting married?
Yeah.
How about
Christiana?
That? Do you think he cries?
Oh, no doubt.
I love it.
Oh, no, he's crying right now. I mean, it's not, you know what? And I've been down that road and it's fine.
Did you cry?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did. But you know what? I'm a sucker. You know, the movie Father of the Bride, Steve Martin, because that always tears me up. And so I actually, tried to circumvent me crying too much at Maggie's wedding by watching the movie like two nights before, just trying to get it out of my system. And all it did was exacerbate the situation. Because you're sitting there and you're about to do it and you look in your daughter's eyes and it's just like, oh my goodness.
I got
to
do it three times, Ernie.
But I wasn't a mess though. It's the greatest, there's this great part. There's this horrible part, but when they mesh together, it just makes for the most unforgettable, cool day. You'll never forget it. You got to do it three times.
Yeah, I got three daughters.
Yeah, I've got, I'll be doing this again at some point too. But it was, to do that. And I was also the best man at my son Eric's wedding. So I've had these wonderful, incredible moments. And so if anybody ever has fun saying, oh, is anybody going to cry? You go ahead, man. If there's ever a reason to cry, it's moments like this.
I have suggested to my daughters that all three get married on the same day.
Mm-hmm.
Cut cost and cut down on the tears.
That would be unique. You know what? I think when Eric and Maggie both got married, they got married a month apart in the same year.
Mm.
So that's why I'm going to be working until I'm 93.
Ernie, great to talk to you. And happy to play a role in some small part in the documentary series.
No, I meant to say that too, Dan. I'm sorry because, they had so many, they talked to so many folks, you included. And the way our editors and everybody, they've done a spectacular job. And I don't know if you've watched the whole thing or any of it at all. But the way they put this thing together and with the comments of folks like you and Wilbon and others and Common and you name it, it's just they did a spectacular job. And it's not me just saying, hey, this is great because it's about our show. But there are times when you watch a show, watch a documentary, something like this and say, man, is that well put together? It really is. So thanks for all your kind words about the show, man. You were awesome.
And if you win another Sports Emmy because of this documentary that I've been praising, that doesn't mm-hmm. seem right, though.
If that happens, I'm just I'm going down to Clark's.
By yourself?
By myself. Yeah.
With your Emmy?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Set me up, Sal.
Yeah. I'll have another round. Thank you, Ernie.
Have a great weekend.
See you, buddy. See you. That's Ernesto Johnson Jr. III, TNT Inside the NBA.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Dan Patrick Show weekdays at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.